I know the reason why you think you gotta leave. Promises of future glory don't make a case for me. I did my best and all the rest is hidden by the clouds. I can't carry you forever, but I can hold you now.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your I get these goosebumps every time of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Leaving now your wedding day, all calm and dressed in white. All I keep's the memory of one last crooked night. The pews are getting filled up, the organ's playing loud. I can't carry you forever, but I can hold you now.
You know what the kids are into right now? Aging, getting older, facing new life conundrums, dads. You know who's out in front of this fire trend for the youth? It's your boys, Vampire Weekend, Vampy Week, Weeky Vamp, Wampy Veek. They are out here. It's Father of the Bride, their first album in TK years. They are back. And if you kids like jams, boy, do they have them. We're going to talk about Vampire Weekend on the cusp of adulthood. John Perellis, chief pop music critic of the New York Times, is here in the studio.
Also on the cusp of adulthood.
True. Not in that jacket. You're on the cusp of youth in that jacket, I want you to know. This is a very fire, faded Levi's jacket that I honestly would be very happy to wear. Thank you, John Perellis, for being here. On the phone, calling in from where I used to get it, Ohio. It's Rob Arvilla. Rob Arvilla of The Ringer.
Yes. How you doing?
I'm tremendous.
You're in a state.
I am. I'm locked in.
I'm locked in. I'm enjoying it much.
Here's the thing. I went into fifth gear. I put a rubber band around the shift stick, and we're driving right to the edge of the cliff today.
Goodness gracious.
So JP reviewed the album for us, and Rob, you did an interesting kind of quasi-oral history about how we kind of got to the current moment, or basically why Vampire Weekend 1.0 was so fascinating to so many. We'll get to that, but let's start with this album. JP, Father of the Bride, I noticed that you didn't give it a critic's pick.
Well, this was what we call in technical terms an error, because it should have been.
Okay, so we're breaking news on Popcast today. Delete your tweets. Breaking news on Popcast. It's a critic's pick, even though it was not listed as such. What happened?
I don't know how to do that at home, so somewhere over the interwebs, the critic's pick seems to have gone astray.
That's true. It's at the bottom of the email. It didn't survive the cut and paste into the CMS. Okay, well, breaking news, Vampire Weekend, Father of the Bride, New York Times critic pick.
A new round of hype can begin now.
That's true. All publicists involved with this project, delete all your press releases, start over. So, JP, Father of the Bride, if you had to rank Vampire Weekend albums, top to bottom, ordinal, where are we at?
I'm putting this at or near Contra, probably just a little behind Contra.
Okay, Contra number one. Rob, where are you at on this?
I'm a Contra man, too. Yep. This will end up three or four, probably. I think the debut, just the circumstances of it, the immediacy of it, like that, I have a sentimental attachment to that record that might have it stick at number two, but they're all really close, you know, and I do think that they flow really well, and I think the sort of depth and intensity and sort of anxiety that comes with this record and is sort of new to this record is a really appealing direction for them. So yeah, if it ends up at the bottom, I don't see that as a pejorative necessarily.
No, it's the least tremendous is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yes. For me, I feel probably similar to you, Rob, in the sense that I think Contra's probably number one. The debut is number two. this is probably number three.
I like this better than Modern Vampires. It's just got a little more transparency to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, JP, what's this album about?
What's this album about? This album is about romantic and societal collapse.
True.
And that's just for fun.
Right, they're party jams about the decline
of Western civilization.
Of all relevant structures.
Pretty much.
Yeah. You kids are into climate change terrorism. We got the jam for you. All that stuff's on here. So
but
skepticism.
Also breakup songs, also mm-hmm. the death of compassion, mm-hmm. also feeling betrayed on every side. And it's all in three major chords that make you dance.
That's true. It's a very accessible record. And I have a question for both of you guys. And this is a non-judgmental question. And if it is judgment attached to it, it is judging myself. So I just want to open with that. I am not particularly fluent in some of the white music that Vampire Weekend is toying with. So I've heard some Grateful Dead things floating around. Like, can you guys map this out for me, a newbie, when it comes to these kinds of things? Can you give me a roadmap?
Well, you're right. There's Grateful Dead. There's the Swingle Singers number in Sunflower.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Van Morrison, Brown Eyed Girl in This Life. There's a lot of early 70s folk rock going on in this.
And just for clarity, before we get emails, that's what I mean when I say this. Anybody who listens to podcast, I would assume knows what I mean. But just in case you're like new to, you like saw Vampire Weekend come up in your Stitcher feed and you're like, wow, I'm going to check out these jams about Vampire Weekend. That's what I'm talking about. Also, act like you've heard the Vampire Weekend debut album. Like, don't be brand new about it. Okay. Anyway, sidebar over. Rob, what do you got?
I love Harmony Hall. Jeez, man, this is rough. Harmony, I feel very judged by everyone. It's fine. I'm going to get through it. I really loved Harmony Hall immediately. I heard sort of the rollicking, you know, less sexually predatory, like Rolling Stones piano thing happening. A friend of mine said Fat Boy Slim, which made a lot of sense to me. Like, that triangulation is very appealing. And like, as you were saying, like, it's a very anxiety filled record, societal collapse, environmental collapse. And like, as a way, you can project whatever you want onto the phrase, but I don't want to live like this, but I don't want to die, is I think a pretty lovely and terrifying way to sum up like the mind state of a lot of people at this specific moment in time.
Welcome to 2019.
Right. So it's not exactly. Just right. So it's not just a sensitive dad frame of mind. It's an alive in the world at this moment of complete and utter imminent collapse.
I also want to do a musical sidebar here.
Yeah, please.
Harmony Hall, the guitar riff of Harmony Hall. If you, as I do, like the guitar riff of Harmony Hall, you can go on YouTube and listen to it for 2 hours looped.
Wow.
Is that right?
Which is a very Vampire Weekend music nerd thing to do, and I've been urging Pedro to run it as a bed under this
entire
podcast.
No, you sure? Pedro says he's not going to do it, but surely there must be a way to do it and then filter out whatever we're saying. So we'll still get the clicks.
Drown out the conversation.
That's what I'm saying. No, ideally. I would like to do that, but still get the clicks. How can I do that? Let's listen to Harmony Hall for as long as you so desire.
We took a vow in summertime. Now we find ourselves in late December. I believe that New Year's Eve will be the perfect time for their great surrender, but they don't remember. Anger wants a voice, voices won't sing. Sinners harmonize till they can't hear anything. Thought that I was free from all that questioning, but every time a problem ends, another one begins. And the stone walls of harmony all bear witness. Anybody with a word in mind can never forgive the sight of wicked snakes inside a place you thought was dignified. I don't want to live like this, but I don't want to die. Ooh.
So speaking of white music, well, I think it's notable because let's go all the way back to 2008. And one of the signatures of early Vampire Weekend was its embrace of guitar styles and rhythms that did not come from traditional indie rock, did not come out of what we think of as a white American or white British rock tradition, which are, of course, all black blues. We know. But the point is, there was an embrace of a lot of African styles, and this was something that set Vampire Weekend apart, especially in the middle of an era where indie rock bands were really doubling down on tradition. They were on doubling down on heritage, basically. And you don't hear that as much right now on what they're doing. And I wonder about the politics of coming in the door with that kind of approach and then landing here. What do you guys think?
Well, there is Rich Man on this album.
Yeah.
Which is African palm wine guitar sampled from the great African palm wine guitarist S.E. Rogie. So presumably he's getting royalties. His estate is getting royalties.
Right.
It also sounds like Paul Simon's voices. No one, I guess, has pointed out this resemblance before, but there's a lot of Paul Simon in Vampire Weekend.
Oh, yeah. No, I would not have known.
More breaking news.
Yeah.
It's clearer here, too. So, I mean, there's a song called Big Blue, which to me reads like partly the only living boy in New York. So Paul Simon's in the mix, you asked. But
that should be the name of their next album.
You asked.
You asked.
I didn't hold the African guitars against them. I mean, Dirty Projectors were using them too.
Of course.
So I mean, it's not unheard of in indie rock. But
just because you didn't or we didn't doesn't mean that it wasn't a point of contention.
But they made it a point of contention. If you call a song Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, you were thrown in people's faces. You're not trying to hide that you're borrowing something.
Let's actually listen to Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, all that hard, hard alliteration. You kids like assonant rhymes?
As much as we like Oxford commas.
Ooh, wow, you got an alliterative title and assonant ass rhymes. Let's go. Is it worth noting while we are here that the era of the first Vampire Weekend demos and album was really pre-Outrage Twitter?
It was pre-Twitter. It was pre-peak Twitter of any form. I think Twitter existed. But yeah, part of what interested me about that era, about 2007 when they were coming up and then the debut album in January 08, was that the critical conversation was largely taking place on Tumblr. Ooh. Or MP3 blogs, or message boards. Yeah, RIP, yeah. And the whiteness, a part of my story that started out small and through the editing process, I think very wisely, kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller, was the fact that a lot of the harshest criticism leveled against those first couple of Vampire Weekend records was the use of the word white or whiteness as a pejorative. Like Ezra himself complained in interviews that like, people called them the whitest band in the world. And that's factually inaccurate, obviously. You know, Ezra's background, Hungarian and Jewish, and Rostam is Iranian American. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just false on its face. But it's also, it's just fascinating to me that in a lot of cases, white critics using whiteness, white, as a pejorative to dismiss music, like as a synonym for like bland or just like uninterested in the outside world, or just that sense of cultural appropriation that always obviously has followed Paul Simon around. What interested me about the sustained, intense cultural argument, critical argument over Vampire Weekend, was that it got so heated, that it got into questions of race and class, and that it was taking place like not on Twitter. Like it seemed like it was a longer and more sustained and more back and forth. And there was more thought put into it, more words poured into it. It wasn't taking place, you know, in these 140 character dumps.
I mean, literally, if Vampire Weekend released Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa today, there'd be like a photo of the band in like sweater vests, the song title Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, and the manual retweet with comment would be like, you hate to see it. Right. Like it would be dismissed so quickly. It would be washed out of the system so quickly right now. That's how it feels.
Upper West Side Soweto.
Right. I mean, literally, can you imagine 2019 Twitter getting a hold of that? And then there'd be like five people being like, whatever, I stand. You know. But obviously, this is a group that chose to engage with those things, that chose, I don't want to call it a provocation, because I don't know if that's exactly right, but I do think that they understood the frameworks that they were toying with, and were toying with, frankly, at a pretty high level, often at a higher level than many of their critics.
I hate to use academic ease, but
please,
what they were doing was problematizing.
So it was more problematizing than problematic, is what you're saying.
Yeah, problematizing is academic for I'm going to raise this issue and use a lot of strange pronouns and complicate things. But I want to go into this cultural appropriation thing. I have another term for cultural appropriation.
Wow.
And I'm not talking about stealing. I'm not talking about slapping your copyright on something you stole while you were on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about cultural appropriation with attribution and context. I call it learning.
Mm-hmm.
I call it learning from other music that you like. I call it the expansion of culture. To do this whole cultural appropriation is bad, and you can't take an idea from anywhere and do something of your own with it, is nuts to me.
And this is something that I think, anticipating the debates that would come in the subsequent years, these are headlong volleys into that, into the maw.
I mean, if you call something Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, you're not saying, this is not Congolese music. Mm-hmm. You're footnoting.
Do you think that their relationship to source material is different now, that they seem to be leaning into different source material, or at least expanding the source material that they are laying their hands on?
This album is very different from the previous albums to me, in that it doesn't feel like a band album. It feels like Ezra Koenig and Ariel Rekshe, the producer, just having the time of their lives in the studio.
What's Rostam's involvement here?
He's not a member of the band. There's one song that's a collaboration, which, who knows, maybe it's old.
Right. There's just one.
Just one.
Okay.
But he's the producer on We Belong Together, that one song.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken him a while to between albums, so who knows if that was something they did together a long time ago. And We Belong Together is we belong together like left and right. It's about opposites.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows, maybe it was a breakup song.
Let's listen to a bit of We Belong Together.
We go together like sand and sand, black and white, day and night. We go together like left and right. Oh, we go together. We go together like give and take, pains and aches, real and fake. We go together, don't be opaque. It's clear we go together. We belong.
I want to say something about the early backlash, too.
Yeah.
How many Ivy League graduates were writing about how horrible it was for these people to be writing about Ivy League life?
Is this where I retreat into the bushes?
No, I'm one.
It's just like, oh.
I'm one, too.
I just want to go on record as saying that I did not particularly enjoy the Ivy League experience. I made the best of it.
Really?
I made my own micro version, but I would not say that my version lined up with very many other people's versions at my institution.
How often were you wearing the boat shoes?
Never, not once.
Okay, just checking.
Oh my God, not even Timberland boat shoes. Like, no, no, my God. No, I wore like 3 pairs of Tims for all of college. Like, this is, I mean, I wore headphones that make the headphones we're currently wearing look like AirPods. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was not participating. I was talking about conscientious objector, probably a lost Vampire Weekend demo. Talking about conscientious objector, like, that's where I was at, just FYI, while we're here.
This is all great information.
This is also my therapy session, so this is good. I'm saving a lot of money on therapy. And while we're on the subject of privilege, I should probably point out that the headline for my 2010 review of Contra, I didn't write the headline, just FYI, but it's Vampire Weekend, Dapper, Privileged, and Unapologetic. And I want to say also that this review, the reason I opened the show with I get those goosebumps every time, is that R.L. Stine himself tweeted about how mean this review is towards Vampire Weekend, and he was defending Vampire Weekend. I mean, maybe it's whoever runs R.L. Stine's social media, but it certainly seemed like it was really R.L. Stine. And I reread this review today, and it's not that mean, just for the record, R.L., if you happen to be listening. Just throwing that out there again.
Okay. Making enemies all over the place.
I've had enemies. I'm just acknowledging them. let's clarify. Let's be factual here.
Whew.
Rob, where are you at from the dad perspective?
Well, again, I really like this record and the depth of feeling that comes with it, you know, and you wouldn't necessarily know listening to it that Ezra is a new father, but knowing that and listening to it, I think adds additional layers to it. You can bring your own troubles and anxieties and you can project whatever you want onto it, but there's enough there that it'll sustain that. I think it still has the foundation of those fairly simple, fairly austere and melodious and just perfectly pure and simple songs from their first record. And it just sort of builds this whole foundation on it. And Grateful Dead is sort of a jocular way of describing, you know, the jam band aesthetic. It doesn't quite work, but there is just an expansion that's very pleasing and it has sort of a dad rock overtone to it. Like I saw them on Fallon this week and there's a fun little visual joke that Rossum left the band and was replaced with like 12 people, you know, like that's got to make him feel pretty good. But it's nice to see that they were just building in a very organic way on top of what they've already done. And the African influences and just the general straight pop approach that they took on those early records, like that's still there. And that's still sort of driving tunes like This Life. But now there's all this other anxiety and all this other instrumentation brought on top of it in a way that it proves it without the whole thing collapsing.
You wrote this piece where you basically interviewed everybody who was at the scene of the original crime.
Yeah.
You talked to critics and label folks, everybody who was around in that 2007-2008 window when this was really starting to happen. Why did you choose to go down that road and what'd you learn?
I was at the Village Voice at that time, you know, and in the mid to late 2000s, like there was...
I'll get you that TV on the radio feature, I promise.
Thank you for that, John. Yes. I appreciate it. There was like a new hot indie rock band every 6 months back then, you know, starting with...
Not even that far apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, like monthly, probably.
Talk about eras I do not miss.
Yeah, totally. Those bands don't miss it either, trust me. You know, starting with Pitchfork and the Arcade Fire, you know, what was that, like 2003, 2002, like... And these are bands, some of them went on to great success and some of them did not. And the ones that did not, like their very band names became synonymous with like this indie rock sort of flame out. You think about Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah. The real bummer of my piece is that I talked to Charles Aaron, who was at Spin at the time, and the quote that I cut, and I was so sad to cut it, is he described clap your hands, say yeah, as like a wet t-shirt that someone left on my couch, which is sort of my favorite description of music in quite a while. I love Charles Aaron. Shout out Charles Aaron.
Oh, Charles Aaron.
It was incredible.
Keeping North Carolina punk.
Exactly. I loved Vampire Weekend immediately, honestly. And I feel like a lot of people did. And the people who didn't, I felt like they hated Vampire Weekend instantly. And that immediacy was really striking to me. You thought, you know, like when you heard A-Punk, Oxford Comma, whatever, whether you heard it at a live show, whether you heard it on MySpace or an MP3 blog or like that austere sort of mysterious CDR that was going around if you were in the press. Like, it was just fascinating that on one hand, like, this is just another indie band with a stupid name that we're all supposed to care about and argue about now. But there was just an immediacy to it that was really striking. And if you immediately launched off into the Paul Simon cultural appropriation whiteness thing, or you just sort of reveled in the directness of it, it just, this was a fun band to argue about and talk about. And as I said, like, you could talk about like race, you could talk about class. And you were doing this at a time when the critical conversation and most of the cultural conversation was not yet on Twitter. This is
right. It was when arguing was still viable.
It was when there was a second paragraph in the argument.
True. Yeah. Wow. Wow.
There you go.
JP just ended Twitter. He just literally just can't. All Twitter is done now.
R.I.P.
Yeah.
And I also felt like this is the last time that like young, handsome men, you know, singing of their libidos was a thing that everybody had to care about. Like, if you think about the larger critical conversation in the years following Vampire Weekend in the late 2000s, early 2010s, I think about like Odd Future. I think about The Weeknd in that initial sort of anonymous House of Balloons mixtape era when it was like, is R&B going to be indie now? Vampire Weekend was one of the last like rock bands that really resonated on a sustained sort of critical level. And you look at Pitchfork, like, right after Vampire Weekend comes the Dirty Projectors and Animal Collective and Grizzly Bear and that strata of bands. But like the Pitchfork album of the year, where it previously would have been Animal Collective or Arcade Fire or something, suddenly it's Kanye West, suddenly it's Solange, suddenly it's Frank Ocean. I think that the strata of critics, and I would include myself in this, that started out very alt-rock based, very indie rock based, Vampire Weekend was sort of the peak of that as the center of the critical conversation. And from there, all the people who, like you, John, who are already leaning more toward pop, toward R&B, toward rap, toward where, you know, mass music was really going, everybody else started moving in that direction almost immediately after Vampire Weekend. Like, this is the end of that wave of people arguing about a rock band in a way that's not arguing about whether they are a rock band. You know, obviously now, you know, I mean, you did the thing. It's like, are 21 Pilots a rock band? Are the 1975 a rock band? Unless you're doing like Greta Van Fleet, like cosplay, like you don't get talked about as a rock band anymore. The way that people were just compelled to argue about Vampire Weekend, whether they loved them or hated them immediately. I don't know if I've ever done a piece like this, which is just like the first time you heard this band, like getting sort of into the wonkier aspects of the critical argument. But it did seem to be a very singular thing in the way that it was the peak of something and it was also the end of something.
I do want to add to that, a lot of the bands that were really kind of popping from, say, 01 to 07, a lot of the bands that were popping were sort of iterative bands. You know, they were re-expressing ideas that had largely been expressed before. And there were stakes in early Vampire Weekend that most bands were not engaged with. And I think you're right, in an era where critical conversation, in so much as that was ever a thing in the 2000s or 2000 moving forward, in an era where that was primed, Vampire Weekend was like exactly a sweet spot band to fall on one side or the other of. And in your piece, you interviewed people who land on both sides. Shout to Jay Shep. But if you go back to the Strokes or whatever, the stakes are not there. Not in the same way. You can just kind of be like, well, they're good. They get it.
Right.
They sound right. But
they weren't polarizing.
No, not in that. Really, no, they were. And if they were polarizing, they were polarizing only in the sense of like, should someone be unearthing this corpse? That, you know, like, that's the polarizing thing. But with Vampire Weekend, that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
They made their own corpse.
Very well put.
I saw Vampire Weekend play Coachella.
Ooh.
In, I don't know what year. What year would Vampire Weekend have played Coachella? It's like
modern
mid-period.
Vampires.
Mid period. 2014.
13, 14, 15.
Yeah, 13 or 14. I don't know. I repress the memory of being in India. But it was one of those years. And a thing that I was very struck by, I remember at the time, is what a really spectacular sunset time of the day festival band Vampire Weekend was. I was blown away because Vampire Weekend's a band I enjoy, but obviously with some skepticism. But I was blown away by how much sense their music made in that kind of context. Hell, maybe this was the Pitchfork Festival. Who could even say? I'm repressing a lot of trauma.
Could be Governor's Ball, too.
It's truly. It could, you know, it could have been Celebrate Brooklyn. Who knows? But
did they have the chandelier? That's the question.
No, I don't think they did. But that music, which is, again, it's piercing. And as you said, Rob, it's melodious and also terse and legible. I was so blown away by how effective it was in this kind of broad picture context. And it really let me feel that Vampire Weekend had legs. It wasn't just this kind of thing that we all argued about in 2008 to 2011, that it was a thing that actually could translate. Because sometimes critics think like, oh, if we're arguing about a band, we're probably the only people that care about it. But here were, you know, tens of thousands of people who were finding very easy entry point into the band, whether they knew it previously or not. And when I listened to Father of the Bride, I was like, oh, they're doubling down on the parts of the band that work amazingly in that context. They are becoming even a more live-oriented, big tent-oriented band. That's how it read to me. And I wonder what you guys think.
I have to say they've always been there. Mm-hmm. I saw them in a festival setting at the All Points West Festival. In the New York, greater New York area. This was 2009.
That was like across the river and it was super muddy?
Yes.
Didn't I see you there?
You did see me there, yes. We had a grand old time watching Coldplay, I believe.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
That was the one that the Beastie Boys were supposed to headline and they had to drop out and Jay-Z took the Beastie Boys place and like that was great. But Vampire Weekend, I want to say they were on stage like leading up to Jay-Z. It was like the national them and the yeah in some order, and this is 2009, so this is maybe they're playing early Contra tunes, but this is mostly the debut, and they already made a ton of sense on that big a stage with that big a crowd and that sort of expansive a setting. Like even those songs, which are, you know, their quietest and their most austere, like it's all there. You know, it's all there and you can blow up the font size without losing, you know, the nuance of it. And so that was really impressive and striking. And so, yeah, it's this band is always scaled up, like immediately, always scaled up to whatever, you know, stage it was on or setting it was in like a really impressive and abnormal way.
But that's the old pop virtues. I mean, that's concision, that's clarity, that's transparency, that's catchy little hooks. And they always had that. This one uses a lot of the weaponry of the modern studio, it seems. I mean, Ariel Rexach is not holding back. This one is also, if you go like every eight bars, something weird happens. It's very un-live band-ish.
Yeah.
Pardon my adjectives. but there's weird edits going on. I mean, you have like Sympathy. There's this like wild pop flamenco thing going on. And then suddenly there's a lone acoustic guitar. There's all these sudden changes which you can only do in the studio.
Can I just say that if Ezra was versioning on you saying unlive bandish, he probably would have rhymed it with Miles Standish.
Another academic term.
I'm just saying, just throwing it out there. And also free idea if anybody wants to take it. Email us at podcastnytimes.com. Maybe we'll play a clip from your song that rhymes unlive bandish with Miles Standish.
Speak for yourself, John.
Pedro, well, you know, I'll do it. We'll do it live. So I actually had one question about something I picked up on Father of the Bride that I wonder if it resonated for anybody else. And that was on Unbearably White. Let's listen to a beginning of Unbearably White. I ran out. I the only one that picked up on maybe Brimful of Asha on this record?
Ooh, that's good.
That is good.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Which, of course, is a record by a non-white band, Corner Shop. I don't know if I'm overreaching by saying that. Pedro, let's play Brimful of Asha by Corner Shop. I'm just throwing it out there. It's not the most original lick ever, but is the first thing I thought of. And I wondered if it was, and, you know, for a band that, that sort of like winks dispositionally, if that was part of the wink.
Makes sense to me.
JP?
You'll have to ask him.
Ezra, let me know if Brimful of Asha was on your mind.
Give him that email again.
Yeah, popcast.nytimes.com. We get a Time Crisis Popcast collab going off. Rob, are your kids into Vampire Weekend record, or are they still on Alice Merton?
Oh, they discovered Old Town Road yesterday. That's gonna Wrangler on their booty. Yeah, that's gonna be. And before the week before that, it was Don't Fear the Reaper. So you figure that one out. I played them a bunch of stuff. Harmony Hall came on the radio a few times. I think I played the debut record, the self-titled record, a couple times while we were playing poker or whatever. And, like, they were into it. Like,
Wait.
Not for money, John. For, like.
Wait, how old are your kids? How old are your kids again?
My kids are 8 and 5.
I am older than that, and I don't even understand how to play poker. So your kids are geniuses, and they're into Alice Merton and Old Town Road. So they basically they have my job anyway.
Basically, yeah, they're coming for you for sure.
All right, I promised JP before we started recording, and I didn't tell you this, Rob, but I'll just tell you now. I have a hot take about Vampire Weekend. I do.
And should I get out the asbestos line?
Yeah. I look, maybe this podcast will implode just at the mere mention of this.
Might be for the best.
Yeah, it's true, right? You just incinerate it. Mm. Okay, so I was surfing the internet, and I came across a 2014 Vulture interview with Ezra. Vampire Weekend's Ezra Koenig on his early influences, blah, 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 blah. And he's talking about listening to the Ramones, that his parents were playing the Ramones for him.
Talk about dad rock.
Seriously. Actual dad. So parents playing the Ramones and Ezra having the wake-up call that they were not being sincere, that they were, like, being sarcastic.
Really?
Right. Well, he was 10. Give him, you know, he's not Rob's kids. You know, like, Rob's kids, no. Not Rob's kids, but, like, you know, Ezra is a little behind the curve, but he figured it out, right? And then I was like, the Ramones. And then I was like, oh, Vampire Weekend's a punk band. Like, they're actually.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Pedro just quit. Pedro literally just quit. Vampire Weekend's a punk band. And here's the thing, right? So on the first album, there's really. It's this incredible blend of sincerity and archness. The posturing, what is the most punk thing you can do in, like, a bedraggled era? It is basically be super square. And they were presenting a square as an aesthetic, a principled aesthetic counterposition to the dominant mode of the day. We also know that Ezra has, like, some secret hardcore tendencies. I saw him play with up at some point.
I was going to say, I was there too, that he did Blitz's Someone's Gonna Die.
So,
and that song and, somewhere on the Lower East Side.
Yeah, I think it was at the Mercury.
Genuinely shocking at the time.
I totally agree. Was it the Mercury Lounge, maybe? I can't quite remember.
It was like, it was a special venue. It was not a place I ever returned to. It was right off Bowery. Our buddy Chris Ryan, I believe, either filmed it or was involved with it. It was like a Rhapsody deal. Like, I don't know. But yeah, it was just a random spot on the Lower East Side. And yeah, right. That was wild.
It was weird. And his shirt, I remember, like, stayed super tucked in. the whole time. And I was like, this, I remember the time being like, this is very punk rock, what's happening right now, this exact moment. And so when I looked back over kind of like proto 1.0 Vampire Weekend, I was like, okay, Vampire Weekend's a punk band. And then I was like, oh, they're into dads now. And that's like basically about as punk as you can be. For like, I mean, you know, short of being in like, I don't know, like Napalm Death or something. But like outside of that, there is a punk undercurrent. So I'm throwing that out there. And now you guys are going to either embrace it and tell me what a genius move it is, or you're going to absolutely plots all over it. Either one's fine.
Wow.
Well, I have two words for you.
JP's about to wash me.
Talking Heads.
Yeah.
Yes. Great.
There we go.
Good band. Solid band.
Square.
Very square.
Square presentation.
Yes.
Up against the Ramones.
Yes. So wait, were you saying more punk than the Ramones is what you're saying?
No. we're not quantifying.
Counterpunk?
Counterpunk.
Contrapunk?
Oh.
Hey!
See?
So we figured that out.
I was right all along. But do you think that the way the Talking Heads embrace squareness is the same way the Vampire Weekend embrace squareness?
Pretty much exactly, yes.
Yeah.
With the African guitars.
Well, yes, that's true. Rob, you had a regretful echo there. You want to share? You want to speak more about it as I get washed on my own show?
Oh goodness! Oh, as a huge Talking Heads fan, yeah, I think that fits, and I think that's very complimentary. And there is a stiffness that sort of is its own provocation. Like we were trying to decide if that's the right word. Like when I was talking to people about this band, I was like, "Were they trolling? Is the song title Cape Cod Quasa Quasa trolling?" And that, especially the 2019. Definition of that word, that didn't sound quite right. But there has always been like a knowingness to them, like a wryness, and like they understand what they're doing to an extent. They understand the reaction that they're causing up to naming a song in 2019 Unbearably White.
Right. You
know,
although,
like,
but
they know how that's going to be taken. They know that there's a stratus of people who are going to just seize on that as proof, you know, that they're still washed.
But like, I want to say that, like, joke. Trolling, you're trolling against something. Punk is an intrusion. Punk is a middle finger. And to me, I agree. I don't think that they are trolling. I think they're knowledgeable, and I think they're engaging in meta commentary, but I don't think they're trolling. Maybe Unbearably White is trolling. You know, that song or that framework is trolling. But I don't think 1.0 Vampire Weekend, even though trolling as we know it now didn't exist, I don't think that they were trolling. I think that there was something kind of like low-key savage about it.
But when they're singing about all these privileged lives and tastes like Darjeeling and whatever, it's satire. I mean, I don't think it's like people who did not see irony in Vampire Weekend were a little, they needed their minimum daily requirement of irony and were lacking it. I mean,
I understand, but the meaning of punk has shifted over the years. Like, I don't think you would identify the same thing as being punk in 2019 as you would in 2008, as you would in like 1988, as you would have in 1977. Like, I feel like it feels to me like a moving target. And I kind of liked, me and my cheap reading of punk, like I like the idea that on a fundamental resistance level, that Vampire Weekend was engaging in some kind of punk or punkish project. Also, they're super into Sublime. So I rest I rest my case.
None punker than Sublime.
That's exactly right. See, that's the other thing. Like Vampire Weekend, talk about being ahead of the curve. Vampire Weekend were really claiming Sublime like 5 to 7 years ago. And only like last week on Twitter were people like, hey, Sublime's pretty good. I also want to say that I was writing for Sublime many years ago. I just want to put that out there. There's a New York Times review.
We all
somewhere.
Know that. John.
That's
there's
one
a,
of us.
There's a Times review somewhere, Barrett. I think I even saw a Sublime with Rome show.
Just
to let you know how real it is out here.
Did you see the Short Bus All-Stars? That's the real...
Wow. No, I think that only toured in Ohio, Rob.
Yeah, probably. That just toured my house. The different rooms of my house. Yeah.
What else is there to say about this fine young band?
Well, they wrote a jazz ballad.
Speak on it.
My Mistake.
Let's hear My Mistake.
Skin under sun, summer breeze, summer break. Oh, I was young then, I'd made my mistake, unaware of the fall, unaware of my fate. There was peace in the valley till I made my mistake. Quake in the night as the stone took its shape. Caught at the border as I made my escape.
So actually, I kind of think this is a double album. 18
yeah, but it's
songs.
Like, but it's like 55 minutes long.
Yeah, but it's 18 songs.
Yeah, but that's like a double Lil Pump album.
Exactly what I was thinking.
Yes, it's dumb long. That's not punk, just for the record.
That's two punk albums.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But this song is kind of the hinge point, and it shows what other directions they could go. Because Modern Vampires had a darker sonority than this album. This album is like determinedly sunny almost all the way through, except for this song. I think it's cut 10 out of 18. It's halfway through the album, and it says, you know, we could go into this darker territory, and maybe we'll go for a song or two, but really we're going back to those three chords.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you feel that Vampire Weekend as a band, is there any incentive for them to grow out of the particular palette that they are, frankly, very, very good at and expert at?
Well, I think they're trying stuff all the time. I mean, you know, they drop in a Hans Zimmer sample. I don't think he's pigeonholing himself. I don't think he's saying, I can only do these things. Ezra Koenig, I'm talking about, is clearly, he's listening widely.
Yes, always has. He has the taste of a great music critic.
Are you looking in the mirror, John?
When am I not? Let's be honest.
He obviously has instincts that he follows that work. He can write these great snappy little tunes, mm-hmm. but Vampire Weekend album 6, I don't know if it's going to sound like this.
Rob, what do you think?
Thanks to Rostam, I think they always had a lot of experimental instincts to them, but I think that now I agree with you that like this record to me is Ezra plus Ariel plus whoever happens to be around. Like it's definitely becoming a more studio oriented and like a group project with Ezra sort of as a curator, for lack of another word. Like it's just, again, seeing on stage, you know, to use Haim basically as backup singers for like a late night show, to have this entire band behind you who goes like the second song that they played for Fallon was like a 6 minute, like pretty jammy thing. You know, he's clearly going broader, clearly going in like the stop making sense sort of direction. And I think that's a great direction for them. And again, like from the beginning, they've been a great festival band, but I think that they're really coming into that now. And I'm really excited to see them in that context. Like the piece that I wrote, and it's always obnoxious to be like the last band to do blank. Like, you know, that's just a good way to have people on Twitter like saying like, what about Tame Impala or whatever? Like, that's yeah, totally
what
bad.
About
like,
Tame Impala? Sorry, I know. Like, I know it's a JP. I know you bang with Tame Impala. I'm sorry.
John, stop yelling at me on Twitter, please.
I'd like to be on record as saying, what about Tame Impala? Anyway.
But it just, they did feel to me like the last of like the mega indie band.
Yeah.
And like a big tent sort of thing that could feasibly headline a Coachella, or more appropriately at this point, like a Bonnaroo. Ooh. And I think that they are growing into it. Like, I've never gotten really into Mac DeMarco and that whole thing, but I hear a lot of what I think people get out of Mac DeMarco on this record, if that makes any sense. Like, I don't hear it, but you hear it, and I'm hearing what I think you're hearing from him, which is like this really laid back and really simple, but also if you want it to be very deep and expansive and immersive kind of thing, like you can choose your own experience. You can just sort of walk by it as a festival stage on the way to something else. Or you can just enjoy A Punk as like a very simple and very direct and immediately appealing song, or you can really get into this record and sort of revel in the fact that it is very sunny, but that the lyrical content is very dark. You know, and the themes are obviously very dark and very reflective of the time we're living in. Like, it's just the all things to all people, all moods to all people sort of aspect, which they had from the beginning, is really broadening in a pretty fascinating way.
Can someone please make the meme where it's a picture of Mac DeMarco on the left and a picture of Ezra Koenig on the right, and it's you versus the guy she told you not to worry about? Or even better, yeah. You versus the Mac DeMarco she told you not to worry about?
Or just the two Spider-Men pointing at each other would be just as effective.
Right, except one is punk.
One is wearing boat shoes. There you go.
Right, a tattered denim vest and boat shoes. Okay, someone, our beloved audience, someone is probably capable of doing that. I would be very thrilled to receive that at podcast.nytimes.com. What song should we go out on? We did not listen to any of the Steve Lacy stuff.
Oh, so go out on Sunflower, the Swingle Singers tribute.
Yes, there are a pair of songs that feature Steve Lacy. One is, I think the better of the two is Sunflower. JP, you want to talk about the sample?
I don't know if it's a sample.
Okay, or the replay.
It might be Steve.
Okay, the interpolation.
Back in the fabulous 60s, there was a group led by Ward Swingle, which used to do Bach with a jazz rhythm section and singing it in scat syllables.
Wow.
And this song is a tribute to the Swingle Singers. Ezra Koenig has clearly heard the Swingle Singers.
This is Sunflower, Vampire Weekend, featuring Steve Lacy. That is our show. Thank you for listening. Thank you to John Pareles and his denim jacket. Thank you to Rob Harvilla and his children who are coming for my job. Listen to every podcast ever. Maybe this is the last one, who can tell? At nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your Tumblr posts about Vampire Weekend circa 2008 at podcastnytimes.com, except my Tumblr post, because Tumblr deleted my Tumblr. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Tumblr. You could subscribe to the podcast where I complain about various other disappearing internet platforms at Stitcher or iTunes or Google Play, anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer, with all the eye rolls this week, who knows if Pedro will be back next? I can't even tell anymore. Pedro is out of Met Separate Media, and we will be back presumably next week. Ba-da-ba-da-boo, ba-da-boo, ba-da-boo, ba-da-boo.